Good morning. This is Christina Malisoff in studio here with my co-host Kieran Riley.
Good morning.
Good morning, Kieran. A little shaky start this morning, but we're here. And I'm very happy to say that I have once again Margot Pelletier back with us. Margot, I interviewed, I don't know, 6 or 7 years ago about a film that she and her partner were making, The Freeing of Sylvia Baraldini. The highlight of that film for me was when I actually got to see it completed. I think it was a year or two ago in Catskill at the community theater.
A couple years ago.
What did we have, a packed audience of about 500, Margot?
Well, it wasn't quite that large, okay. But it was a full house and a very receptive
right.
audience. Yeah.
And now it will be playing, along with the Black Power mixtapes and other films, down at Bard College, which Margot will tell us more about. Join us for the second half hour at 10:30 for the folks from Milk Not Jails. And we will have a synergistic morning of political activity here.
All right. I can't wait to see Freeing Sylvia Baraldini. The subtitle here is One Country's Terrorist is Another Country's Revolutionary. And this film was the winner of the Best Documentary Award at the 2010 Harlem International Film Festival, among other acknowledgments.
Margot, first of all, tell us a little bit about the film and what is going on down at Bard. And also, Margot, you are the producer and the director of the film?
Well, both Lisa Thomas and myself are the producers and directors of this film, yes. And first, let me thank you very much for giving me time on air again. I so appreciate it. Yeah, I want people to know that the Difference in Media Project, operating out of Bard College, is having a 3-day festival in honor of Black history. And it's happening through February 21st through February 23rd. All of the films are happening at the Weiss Cinema, which is located in Campus Center, which is pretty much the center of the campus. Mm-hmm. And they're all taking place at 8 p.m.
Okay.
And the first day, the 21st, they will be playing the Black Power mixtape. Very exciting film, which is traveling around the country and internationally, and we can talk a little bit about it.
I have to say, I saw it within the last 6 months.
At TSL.
Were you there, Kieran?
I missed it because I was away for last day of them showing it, and for some reason, I always find out about movies that I really, really want to see on like the last night that they're showing, and then I can't go.
Okay,
but that's going to change this year. I'm sorry.
No, but I have to say that that, along with The Freeing of Sylvia Baraldini, those two films, if you didn't live through those times, through the late 60s, early 70s, through the Black Power movement, they are both, I would say, a strong education of what was happening then, the issues and the people and the mover and shakers. But anyway,
right.
I should continue.
To move on to the second day, on the 22nd, there's going to be a series of shorts. There's 6 different filmmakers and 7 different shorts. The filmmakers will be present for a panel after the screenings, which is very exciting. And on the third day, the 23rd, they'll be playing Lisa's and my film, Freeing Sylvia Baraldini. So all of them happen at 8 o'clock. Our film will be followed by a Q&A. Both Lisa and I will be present for that.
That's wonderful. We actually are going to hopefully play a couple of segments. We won't be able to play from Sylvia Baraldini, but we will play a segment from the Black Power mixtapes. Can you tell us, first of all, Sylvia Baraldini, Italian national, or I think she has a citizenship in both Italy and the U.S.?
She actually never obtained citizenship in the U.S. She's an Italian citizen.
But going to school, tell us a little bit about her and what started you in your interest in filming her.
Okay. Well, she came here when she was a teenager. Her dad had a job at the embassy, and she immediately argued with her parents to go to public school. And once she hit public school, she was in Washington, she ran into Friends of SNCC. Mm-hmm. And
which
they
Southern
Student Negro Nonviolent Coordinating Committee.
Exactly. Yes, yeah. And she became slowly politicized. And she was very influenced by the civil rights struggle. This we're talking now in the early 60s. So she then argued to go to the University of Wisconsin, which was kind of a hotbed of activism. And that's where she ran into the Black Panthers. They were actually organizing on that campus. So she became increasingly political, came to New York, was a political activist for 15 years, mm-hmm. Was one of the founding members and national leader of the May 19th Communist Organization, which we can get into a little later. It's actually where I really wanted to talk about the intersection of the Black Power movement or the movement of national liberation struggles for self-determination and how they related to the white left, in particular to May 19th. But in any case, she went on to deepen her commitment, was one of the people that helped to free the Black Panther and political prisoner, Assata Shakur, was eventually arrested for that and convicted for that, given 43 years in prison, served 24 years, was released in 2006, unexpectedly, in her homeland in Italy, and is now living there and doing quite well, still doing political work. Has a lovely partner, and it's kind of a happy ending, in a sense. I mean, not in the larger sense.
Minus the 24 years. I can't believe she did that much for nonviolent crime, particularly.
And also did a good portion of it in a supermax jail.
Yes, 2 years in a very infamous supermax prison. The first one set up for women political prisoners in the United States, and it was called the Lexington Control Unit.
Oh, Lexington. Okay. Could I just ask, does the film then get into a little bit of the issue of prisons in America, and particularly women in prison today?
The film visits her time in the Lexington Control Unit, definitely. And then it also juxtaposes that with her time in a general population prisoner. I wanted to show that political activists don't stop being political activists when they go inside. So we show her in general population as a teacher of adult education and Black history and, you know, working with AIDS and other things.
Assata Shakur, her relationship, this is building up her work with the Panthers. Can you talk about a little bit about that and her broadening consciousness about her work with the Panthers and their work in the community specifically and how that arrived at her conviction of, with, I think, very little evidence of,
yeah.
of freeing Assata Shakur.
Yeah. Well, she was initially involved in the Panther 21 trial, which was a trial where the United States government and the New York State authorities tried to convict 21 Panthers of bombing department stores and police stations. And the trial ended in a total acquittal of 156 charges. And that was, of course, a very big eye-opener for many people in the left, but certainly Sylvia's, you know, close involvement with that both built a personal relationship to the Panthers, but also increased her political understanding of the system at large. And then when Assata Shakur was being transported, Assata Shakur, there was an enormous campaign to criminalize Assata Shakur. And there were posters put up all over the New York area asking for her. Well, actually, there were shoot to kill orders on the poster. And they claimed her being a bank robber. So they had a picture of her born name. The name she was born with was Joan Chesmar. Right. So they had a picture of a African-American woman with the name Joan Chesmar under it, wanted dead or alive, and they spread these posters throughout the New York area. Her life became unbearable, so she went underground. She was being transported to a safe house, And the car she was in was pulled over by New Jersey state troopers, and a shootout ensued. An alleged shootout ensued, in which a state trooper was killed. One of her comrades was killed, Zaid Malik Shakur, and she was shot in her right arm. She was actually left on the side of the road in hopes that she would not survive. She did survive. She eventually was convicted of both murders, her comrades and the state troopers.
I'm sorry, we're still talking about Asada Shakur.
We're talking about,
right?
Asada Shakur,
Sylvia,
yeah.
Okay.
And they had a huge trial in which she was convicted, and she went to prison. She was put in horrible situations, mostly in men's prisons, for 6 years. And then the movement led by the Black Liberation Struggle decided that it would be very significant politically and certainly personally to break her out. And that's when they solicited people that they had a relationship to. And first there was an enormous campaign to expose the idea that she had had a sort of like a legal lynching. Mm-hmm. And Sylvia was involved in that. And so she worked for a committee called Friends of Asada and Sundiata. And in any case, eventually, Asada was liberated. It's true what you said. Nobody was harmed. It was a remarkable event that probably couldn't take place today. Two men went in. They showed their ID. Their ID checked out with the prison administration. They drew guns. They took the guards as hostage. They went into where Asada was waiting. They took Asada out. They commandeered a prison vehicle. They handcuffed the guards to the seats the way prisoners are transported. They drove to a nearby institution for retarded children where a car was waiting. They put Asada in the car and drove away. Eventually, I think it was about a year and a half later, Asada Shakur surfaced in Cuba and was given asylum.
And she's still there, I believe. Is that correct?
That is correct. Okay. She's still there. A couple years later, there was a witch hunt for political activists, and they then arrested Sylvia Baraldini and then brought her to trial and convicted her of helping to free Asada Shakur. So that's the intersection, which I love, between a white revolutionary and a Black revolutionary.
A half hour goes by quickly. Let's talk about that intersection right now. Let's talk about why the U.S. government was so afraid of the Panthers. What did that movement represent out of coming out of the movement in the South, the nonviolence movement? Just very briefly, how did that consciousness shift in the African American population? What were the Panthers after, and how did that cross over to people like Baraldini? Because with some of the clips and what you'll see in some of the Black Panther mixtapes is the beginning, the nascent consciousness that Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Started to reveal in his Beyond Vietnam speech was this understanding of U.S. imperialism, and that the cause was an international cause. And that became very strong in Black nationalists and Black power in the Black power movement. So,
right. Okay.
Sorry.
No, it's a huge question, but I think the biggest threat. I mean, I'm not the right person to answer the question. I'm not African American. I'm not part of the Panthers. But of course, I was very influenced by them, and I can talk about my influence and Sylvia Baraldini's influence as I understand it. Now, these were people that were serving the needs of their people. That is about power. I think there were two aspects to the Black Power movement as I understand it. One was about self-esteem and self-respect. We are beautiful. And we really need to internalize that, okay? But the other was about power. And the way I see it as self-determination. And that's the way the organization that Baraldini led saw it, that it was only right that all oppressed nations be able to determine for themselves how they want to be governed. And certainly the Panthers, even within the imperialist system, took it upon themselves to set up clinics for their communities, schools, breakfast programs. And they were, I think they were working on two fronts. While they were working to help all of us understand that the imperialist system, the capitalist system that had expanded to imperialism, innately could not provide for people, that it was based on profit, and that that was their main concern. At the same time, they weren't like waiting for it to fall. They were immediately giving their communities what they needed to maintain their health. And, you know, to be better educated.
Empowering those communities and almost creating a structure outside of the system, which to me is very much a parallel for the some of the Occupy movements that are going on right now.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And food and healthcare, like you mentioned, the healthcare clinics, you know, this is about being able to take care of ourselves. Not that, you know, there's nothing wrong with, you know, like the food stamps program or Medicare. You know, as a society, we should take care of our sick and our hungry. But this is about communities taking back the resources and taking back the means of being able to feed their own children, for example. And that's why the breakfast program was one of the biggest, most successful programs of the Black Panther Party, right?
Yes.
We're going to go to this is a piece with Angela Davis speaking from the Black Power mixtape. And I'm hoping to get this on. Let's see if we can do it. Nope. Okay. So we have something else playing. Maybe we can, but we can.
Okay. Can I just repeat who we're talking to, Christina, and just mention to people out there listening, we're talking to Margot Pelletier about her recent film called Freeing Sylvia Baraldini, which will be showing down at Bard College Thursday, February 23rd as part of the film series.
And Margot, while we're waiting to get that piece, that clip on, I mean, we can talk a little bit more about what Baraldini's first of all, I'd like to ask, what is it, how your connection to creating this film?
And okay.
Yeah, because it's really important as a director.
Okay, I actually was a political activist in the early 80s, and I worked with Sylvia Baraldini. And I was one of the members of the Madame Ben Graphics Collective, which was essentially May 19th's propaganda center. And I also eventually did a very short term in prison myself as a political prisoner. I was arrested doing an action against the South African rugby team that had come into the country breaking a UN mandate. And I served 6 months at Rikers Island, which gave me a small taste of what it meant to both oppose the state, but also how differently political prisoners are treated from the general population, and also who's in prison. You know, it was a big eye-opener for me as a white middle-class woman to see the prisons are filled with regular people. You know, people.
Nonviolent offenders, marijuana, petty marijuana convictions, mostly the poor, I'm assuming.
Yeah.
Actually, Angela Davis talks about that in a piece that I'm planning to play sometime in the near future, a two-part piece where she talks about, you know, where are all the poor is the question that was asked her. And she said they're now being disappeared into U.S. prisons. And in fact, goes on to talk about the prison system itself as historically being part of the same system that brought slaves to this country, and in fact has really nothing to do with keeping the streets safe. But let's see if we can go to that to Angela Davis herself speaking. I believe this is in the early '60s. Let's see if we can get this going now.
And she's still speaking around the country sometimes, so keep an eye open.
Her. Confrontation? Violence?
Oh, is that the question you were asking?
Yeah.
You ask me, you know, whether I approve of violence. I mean, that just doesn't make any sense at all. Whether I approve of guns. I grew up in Birmingham, Alabama. Some very, very good friends of mine were killed by bombs, bombs that were planted by racists. I remember from the time I was very small, I remember the sounds of bombs exploding across the street, our house shaking. I remember my father having to have guns at his disposal at all times because of the fact that at any moment someone, we might expect to be attacked. The man who was at that time in complete control of the city government, his name was Bull Connor, would often get on the radio and make statements like, niggers have moved into a white neighborhood, we better expect some bloodshed tonight. And sure enough, there would be bloodshed. After the four young girls who lived, one of them lived next door to me. I was very good friends with the sister of another one. My sister was very good friends with all three of them. My mother taught one of them in her class. My mother, in fact, when the bombing occurred, one of the mothers of one of the young girls called my mother and said, can you take me down to the church to pick up Carol? We heard about the bombing, and I don't have my car. And they went down, and what did they find? They found limbs and heads strewn all over the place. And then after that, in my neighborhood, all of the men organized themselves into an armed patrol. They had to take their guns and patrol our community every night because they did not want that to happen again. I mean, that's why when someone asked me about violence, I just find it incredible. What it means is that the person who's asking that question has absolutely no idea what black people have gone through, what black people have experienced in this country since the time the first black person was kidnapped from the shores of Africa.
That was a cut from the Black Power mixtapes, which will be showing the first.
The 21st at 8 p.m. at Weiss Cinema in Campus Center at Bard. And I'd like to give the address of Bard for those of you that want to Google it. It's Annandale on Hudson, New York, 12504-5000.
I thought it was in Tivoli. Maybe that's part of Annandale on Hudson.
Yeah, actually, there was a Steely Dan song about Bard. But one of the things that really struck me about the Black Power mixtapes, which, by the way, was unseen footage that was a group of, I think they were Swiss?
Yeah.
Swedish.
Swedish, yeah.
Sorry. Swedish.
Swedish, Swiss.
Filmmakers.
Swedish, fish, sorry.
Unseen in our country.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and
it had already.
And I think I'm going to go to a clip of Stokely Carmichael, but did you want to say something before that?
Well, the way it got started is so interesting to me. A young Swedish journalist, Ingrid Dullberg, traveled to New York to interview Stokely Carmichael because she was very interested in showing people in her own country sort of the real deal, mm-hmm. a real picture of the Black Power movement. And that footage was shown in Sweden, but never in this country, went into a basement for over 40 years. Another filmmaker, documentary filmmaker, Goran Hugo Olsen, found it and realized that he had struck gold, essentially. And at the same time, he found clips of Angela Davis and other members of the Black Panther Party, and then went about, you know, really looking and found as many as entries from as many as 20 different Swedish broadcastings, and that is the material that he put together.
And again, you know, for people who are listening to this, whether you lived through this period, I was a little bit young, but I remember it, or folks who are much younger who don't remember this, this is a part of history that was literally this country tried to exterminate. I'm not talking about just, you know, eradicating books or I mean, they tried to eradicate the people who actually created this. Many became had to leave the country. Stokely Carmichael became Kwame Ture and was living, I forget in where in Africa, but
Guinea.
And, yeah.
But yeah. Eldridge Cleaver was abroad, and of course, some weren't so lucky, such as George Jackson in prison, and such as Fred Hampton in Chicago.
And then this was also during a period when this was the beginning of independence movements. Okay. If anybody listened to Democracy Now! Right now, this morning, and heard about the couple of hundred prisoners who died in a fire in a country that in Honduras that receives aid, U.S. money, the history of U.S. Support of dictatorships still has not ended. And there, but at that time, there were countries you can Stokely Carmichael supporting countries like Cuba and Angola and other countries that were like Patrice Lumumba, who were trying to shake off the imperial reigns, yep. Post-colonial imperial reigns. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just had one question back to the film, if you don't mind.
Not at all.
I think we're getting to the half hour mark, unfortunately. Okay. But I wanted to ask, just in your work with this research on Silvia Baraldini. Could you give us a few more words on who she is today and how she feels about... This is someone who spent 24 years in horrible conditions in prison. And a lot of people you would think, after having gone through that... I saw the movie about the Weather Underground, for example. A lot of them were so remorseful of the message. The underlying message of the documentary was kind of, now don't do this, kids. You know, as this sort of like, we were misguided, we were wrong. And I'm wondering if there's some sort of... message. I don't want to give away the whole movie, obviously, but some sort of message that Silvia might have to share with all of us who aspire to similar sort of ideals today, if you want to comment a little bit on who she is.
Okay, that's kind of a multifaceted question. But well, certainly revolutionaries are made, not born. Okay, so they come out of the conditions. But once they're made, they're very remarkable people. And jail... I mean, not in every case, but in most cases, jail does not break them. And, I mean, for example, if Che Guevara went to jail, we wouldn't be asking the question, did he, you know, become a soccer player after he got out, you know? And it's the same situation. I think it's not as understandable for us to embrace a white woman revolutionary. You know, it's a very unusual... construct for a lot of people, but she's still incredibly political, and her commitment only deepened. But she really believes that the younger generation has to have their turn to create the kind of struggles they want to create, and to create the kind of world they want to create. So she hasn't exactly, you know, she's not exactly stepping aside. She does do work for the Cuban Five, and she travels and speaks a lot. But she has said, it didn't come out in the movie, but it was in our interviews, that her generation had their turn, and she's hoping that people will gain insights from both their mistakes and their successes, but that they need to move aside because it's very hard to give up power.
yes, as we know, we're still in the struggle. We're going to go quickly to this interview with Stokely Carmichael, who is a main, I would say, a good feature in the Black Power mixtapes. So let's see if we can go to that now.
In this country, you were to think that white people were God, that they had the right to give us our freedom. And so what we had to do was to beg them or to act the way they want us to act before they gave us our freedom. We must stop seeking to imitate white society. We must create for ourselves to save our very humanity. because the fight for black power in this country is indeed a fight to civilize a barbaric country, the United States.
We have to be able to gather the strength. You must be able to get the guts as the intellectuals of the black society to say, we are black. Our noses are broad. Our lips are thick. Our hair is nappy. And we are beautiful. And we are beautiful. And we are beautiful. And we are beautiful. Yes. Yes. We are beautiful.
That was Stokely Carmichael. And I think very quickly, we're still waiting for the Milk Not Jails people to call in, which I will call them soon. But I'm going to play someone who was not in either movie, but who is a personal hero of mine. And that is James Baldwin, who is not only African-American, but also gay, and wrote some amazing, one of my favorite authors, Go Tell It on the Mountains, one of the, but Giovanni's Room, and a number of other The Fire Next Time, with his coming in contact with Malcolm X and the Muslim
Nation of Islam.
Nation of Islam. Thank you. Okay, let's see if we can go and play this next.
Well, I know this, and anyone who's ever tried to live knows this. So what you say about somebody else, you know, anybody else, reveals you. What I think of you as being is dictated by my own necessities, my own psychology, my own fears and desires. I'm not describing you when I talk about you. I'm describing me. Now here in this country, we've got something called a nigger. It doesn't in such terms, I beg you to remark, exist in any other country in the world. We have invented the nigger. I didn't invent him. White people invented him. I've always known, I had to know by the time I was 17 years old, what you were describing was not me, and what you were afraid of was not me. It had to be something else. You had invented it, so it had to be something you were afraid of. And you invested me with. Now that's so. No matter what you've done to me, I can say to you this, and I mean it. I know you can't do any more, and I've got nothing to lose. And I know, and I've always known, you know, and really always, that's part of the agony. I've always known that I'm not a nigger. But if I am not the nigger, and if it's true that your invention reveals you, then who is the nigger? I am not the victim here. I know one thing from another. And I know I'm going to born and I'm going to be, you know, I was born, I'm going to suffer and I'm going to die. And the only way you get through a life is to know the worst things about it. I know that a person is more important than anything else. Anything else. I learned this because I've had to learn it. But you still think, I gather, that the nigger is necessary. Well, he's unnecessary to me, so he must be necessary to you. And I give you your problem back. You're the nigger, baby, he isn't me.
Take This Hammer, filmed with James Baldwin in the spring of 19...
Okay, so we're back. We're going to take a quick musical break, and actually, before we do that, I just want to, Margo, I just want to, is there anything else that you wanted to add, or, I mean, it's such a big topic, I almost feel like we should have you back. And
oh, that'd be wonderful.
Yes,
well, I just want people to know that there will be opportunity to discuss a lot of these same issues that are going to be coming out of this festival. You know, I don't know if they're going to be able to do a Q&A after Black Mix. I'm sorry.
The Black Power
Mixtape. But certainly among oneselves, people will be discussing it. But the next day, with the six filmmakers and the seven shorts, there'll be a whole panel. So it's a wonderful opportunity. That's the 22nd at Bard in Weiss Cinema in Campus Center. And certainly after Freeing Sylvia Baraldini on the 23rd, there'll be a Q&A. And we so welcome people's comments.
Okay, great. Is there a fee for that or is it free?
This is all free.
Okay, that's really great. So I'm planning to be there and I hope to see some of you folks there too. And thank you so much, Margot, for coming in.
Oh, thank you.
We're going to go
through. Absolutely. It's been a pleasure having you.
Thank you.
A quick musical break, and then we'll have the Milk Not Jails people. And actually, Margot, I'd like to ask you to join us if you'd
I'd
like
love to
sit,
to.
In,
sure.
sit in for that.
Whoop, whoop. That's the sound of the police. Whoop, whoop. That's the sound of the beast. Whoop, whoop. That's the sound of the police. Whoop, whoop. That's the sound of the beast. Whoop, whoop. That's the sound of the police. That's the sound of the beast. Whoop, whoop. That's the sound of the police. Whoop, whoop. That's the sound of the beast. Stand clear, done man attack. You can't stand where I stand, you can't walk where I walk. Watch out, we run New York. Policeman come, we bust him out the park. I know this for a fact, you don't like how I act. Will you be doing that? I'd rather say see ya, cause I would never be ya. Be a officer, your wicked overseer. Your hotshot, you wanna get pops and be a savior. First show a little respect, change your behavior. Change your attitude, change your plan. There could never really be justice or stolen land. Are you really for peace and equality? Or when my car's hooked up, you know you wanna follow me. Your laws are minimal, cause you won't even think about looking at the real criminal. This has got to cease. I'm to the sound of the police. Whoop, whoop. That's the sound of the police. Whoop, whoop. That's the sound of the beast. Whoop, whoop. That's the sound of the police. Whoop, whoop. That's the sound of the beast. There's a little truth. Open up your eye while you're checking out the boombox. Check the exercise. Take the word overseer like a sample. Repeat it very quickly and approve for example. Overseer, 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 officer. Yeah, officer from overseer.
Okay, that was a little KRS-One, and hopefully right now we will have Milk Not Jails, Lauren from Milk Not Jails on. Can you hear us, Lauren?
I can. Hi.
Hey, fantastic. Thank you so much for joining us. And Lauren, if you can talk right into your receiver, it really makes a difference on the sound quality here.
Okay.
Okay. And Lauren, can you tell us a little bit about who, what your role is in Milk Not Jails, who founded it, and what is Milk Not Jails?
Sure. Well, I founded Milk Not Jails in March 2010 after many years of collaborating with a lot of wonderful people in the criminal justice movement and in...
Lauren, can you speak up just a little bit louder? I'm sorry.
Sure.
Oh, that's much better.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah, that's much
okay.
better.
So I founded Milk Not Jails in March 2010 after working with a lot of great activists in the criminal justice movement and in... trying to support local farmers getting their food into some of New York City's neighborhoods. And we had all been organizing around both of these issues and had been frustrated on the criminal justice end where we'd done a lot of legislative advocacy at the way that a lot of rural state senators respond to criminal justice reform. I'm not sure how many people are familiar with the landscape of New York State's prison system, but it's very big. Most of the prisons, in fact, 90% of them are located in rural areas, and they provide a lot of jobs in their in those communities.
Right.
But the guard union and the politicians that represent them often advocate for highly punitive policies that kind of keep people in prison longer than studies show is recommended. and they kind of push back reforms that numerous advocates and legal professionals have suggested would reduce recidivism and keep communities together and reduce crime. So we started the campaign to highlight this issue that the prison industry is an economic engine in rural New York, but it doesn't have to be. And what we're doing is seeking out relationships with dairy farmers, who are the majority of New York's farmers. I think they sell 80% of agricultural sales in New York State are from dairy farms. We're seeking out relationships with them to try and carve out new urban-rural economic relationships to strengthen the sale of products made by New York State farms and diversify the rural economy so that it doesn't have to be dependent on the prison industry.
So you're talking about a two-pronged movement here. One is the criminal justice issue, which is the prison industrial complex, or the idea that the prison industry keeps itself in supply of prisoners,
right,
through different through legal processes and also structural causes. And then the second part of this, you're saying, is to for New York State to re-embrace its agricultural, upstate New York, its agricultural roots. Although, ironically, when we talked last time, or I didn't talk to you, but I talked to you, the other person who talked about how you guys were in Brooklyn and how Brooklyn at one time was all farmland, which is hard to believe right now. So what I'm getting at is if you can talk about first the rural portion of this. When I look at your policy, if people go to Milk Knot jails and they look at your rural and farm policies, there's a list of these policies. One is to protect New York's farmland, to keep the Hunts Point market open, increase New York farm food in schools, to legalize the sale of raw milk products and lower farmers' taxes, and resubsidize small farms. These are some of those policies on that one hand. And then the criminal justice policies you list are passed the Safe Parole Act, which we had 2 weeks ago, someone talking about that, which is parole reform, and racist marijuana arrest, uphold the law to draw districts based on where people in prison call home, and pass the Domestic Violence Survivors Justice Act, free New York political prisoners, and close empty prison beds. How did you come to these policies?
Well, our campaign is trying to build relationships directly between farmers and consumers, but because we want to make farming a viable part of New York's rural economy, which it has been. It's been the cornerstone of the rural economy for centuries, and oftentimes politicians think of it as a pastime, you know. It is dying out, but what we're trying to do with this policy agenda is make some structural changes that allow small family farms to thrive in this global economy. And so the policies that you listed off are policies that farmers and criminal justice advocates have suggested to us that, you know, making these changes would allow them to, on the farm side, allow them to hold on to their farms or pass them on to other younger farmers that can't afford farmland at, you know, development rates, but can afford them if they're protected farmland. Mm-hmm. So, you know, farmers have suggested all of the policies that you listed off as structural changes that could allow them to keep their land in production, increase their sales, compete in the global market. And then the criminal justice policies are ones that activists that we've worked with for years have also suggested. There's active campaigns around all of the issues that you listed. And so what we're trying to do is galvanize more support for those policies and bring strategic voices to both of those ends. So we want to make sure that when farmers are advocating for farmland protection, that we've got thousands of consumers in urban areas also advocating for those things because they feel connected to those farms. And we want to make sure that when urban constituents are advocating for parole reform, we have people in rural New York supporting those efforts and providing another, you know, voice in their districts than just the typical politician that wants to make sure that there's guard union jobs protected in their county.
And you have a conference coming up. Can you talk a little bit about that, the Eat, Work, Grow, the Movement Conference?
Sure. Just Food is a nonprofit based in New York City that has primarily made a name for itself by helping neighborhoods in New York City organize CSA distribution sites with farms in Long Island and Hudson, in the Hudson Valley. And they have a great conference coming up next week to bring together people in the CSA world to talk about how to organize these alternative institutions and also talk about policies that are coming up, like the Farm Bill. We're going to be there giving a workshop about milk not jails, but we'll also be there to meet with CSA organizers and sign them up to sell dairy products from the farms that have signed on to the Milk Not Jails policy platform.
Hi, Lauren. This is Kieran here. Thank you for being with us. This is so wonderful to see this campaign that you're working on.
Thanks.
It seems like almost an unlikely alliance between farmers, farm reform, and criminal justice reform. One thing that strikes me about the peculiarity is in upstate, the criminal justice system is actually another one of our major employers up here in upstate, as I'm sure you know. And so it's asking to kind of relook at the entire system of the prisons upstate, but also the monopolized farms upstate. Dean Foods, I'm seeing you're noticing Dean Foods having monopoly over 80% of the entire dairy. Is that in the state or in the entire country? I know
that's in the Northeast region. I'm not sure what kind of control they have in New York State markets, but I'm sure it's pretty high.
Well, this is fantastic. You're really highlighting an issue of monopolization of the farms, but also like complete corporate monopolization and profits in the prison system itself. And I would advocate, here I go again, but I would advocate even going further with the criminal justice policies and really taking a look at how the policing is done in communities, what kind of funding is going towards policing and homeland security, the continuous criminalization of black communities and this so-called war on terror and war on drugs, this fabricated sort of wars on poor people. And, okay, here I go, but let me just back up and ask, so is there about the overlap between the criminal justice system and farming? I know there's been some very highly successful programs as part of prisons for organic farms, opening up vegetable gardens outside of the prison walls, and I know that that's been programs. Do you guys have anything to do with that at all, or do you want to comment a little bit on any of those programs? Because it would seem if you catch poor kids when they're 16, 17, I know because I went and worked at Roxbury Farm when I was 16 years old, and I know Just Food from way back. And it really helps kids get out of trouble and find meaningful work. And you want to just comment on that? I know I'm off topic here. Sorry, guys, but I'll stop.
No, it's not off topic at all. New York State, the Department of Correctional Services, actually did have 12 farms that they were running at some of the state prisons for 30-plus years. And they were producing food for the prisons. They were producing food that they were selling outside of the prisons. They had processing equipment and warehousing facilities that other farmers in the area could utilize. And a couple of years ago, when the Department of Corrections was trying to save money, they decided to cut that program. And their justification for cutting it was that farming is not meaningful job training for urban people. And so, you know, that kind of statement or that kind of perspective really shows a very short-sighted perspective on how meaningful farming can be, you know. You may not be able to find a job at a Brooklyn farm when you're coming out of prison because there aren't so many of them left, but it doesn't mean to say that having that experience isn't a really positive one for people in prison and the farmers working there.
I just
it's a real shame that they cut that program when, you know, they could have cut 6,000 empty prison beds that they were actively supervising.
Right, right. Because of the, can you comment also on the privatization of prisons? Because I'm still interested in that structure, that self-fulfilling structure that needs more prisoners, you know, feed us more to keep us going so that we can keep our jobs, keep our profits.
Yeah, in New York State, the prison is not privatized. That seems to be more of a trend in the South. So the states with the biggest prison systems, like New York and California, are actually still public facilities. But that's not to say that, you know, that prison industrial complex, this idea of building a system and then wanting to keep it running because it's providing so many jobs, isn't happening here. I think I was living in a very rural county in a prison town a couple of years ago to just get a better handle on how it fit into the economy. And 40% of the people in that county work for the government, you know, for the county or the state or the federal government. And so when you destroy things like farming and other rural industries, then you have a population that's really dependent on government jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes they'll advocate for really bad policies just to make sure that they have those jobs because they're the steadiest jobs in the area.
Mm. Good point. The other thing that you mentioned also is that a prisoner may not have a job at a farm if they get released in Brooklyn, but actually I had a personal situation where a family member of mine, I moved upstate, and when that relative finally did get out of jail, I grew up in the city, instead of having them go through work release down in the city, it was actually really healing and really good, and I felt much more comfortable having them go through a work release program in upstate New York. Just because it's a more rural area and it's less heavily pressured with drugs and crime. So can you also comment on maybe that connection, perhaps, of prisoners deciding instead of returning back to an urban environment, maybe seeking something as an alternative?
Sure. I mean, I'm not really familiar with any statistics. I know the majority of people that do come out of prison return to the communities that they came from. But I have met a lot of people who have decided to stay upstate where they think that there are more job opportunities, a better community that they've built while they've been incarcerated. And, you know, farming jobs are definitely available, you know, should be available to people coming out of prison, but there's also tons of jobs that can be built around the food system for urban and rural people. And Milk Not Jails is building a milk marketing cooperative with farmers that want to take a criminal, you know, a stand on these policies with us. And we're working with some reentry programs in New York City to build a job training and placement program for people coming out of prison to drive the delivery trucks and do the marketing and sales in New York City. So I think, you know, there's definitely a lot of jobs in agriculture that could be built both in urban and rural areas, and having the farm program in the New York State facilities was definitely beneficial in more ways than you can really count in terms of just whether or not it provided adequate job skills, you know.
This is, again, I just want to say, Lauren, this is really fantastic what your organization is doing in overlapping these two issues which are very, very much close to my heart as well. And we're starting to run out of time, unfortunately, but we previously interviewed Margot Pelletier, who's actually still here with us in the studio, talking about her recent documentary film on Silvio Baraldini and talking about the Black Power movement. And I'm just struck, I'm having to go back to that for a second now, because this whole idea of farming and small farms in your community, family farms, really has to do with self-reliance, self-determination, being able to feed your own communities with what you choose of good, healthy food. It just seems to be the antidote to a lot of the problems we're having with poverty and with the prison system. And I'm just wondering, in a few more minutes, Margot, maybe if you had any questions for Lauren or comments on what we've been hearing?
Well, if you don't mind, I kind of wanted to say something very personal.
Mm-hmm.
Because when I was in Rikers Island in 1982, they actually did have a huge garden, and it doesn't exist any longer. But the great thing about it was the women prisoners were not allowed to work the garden, but the male prisoners were. And being in prison is very much an indoors event.
Mm-hmm.
And it was wonderful just to even look out the window and see some of the inmates outside in the garden, you know, weeding and everything. But in addition, because the diet was very poor and very sugar-based, every single day we had coleslaw, which is very high in iron.
Okay.
So when I first heard that they did away with that whole thing, it was very depressing.
Okay.
I mean, that's just a little personal story about, you know, doing prison time and being able to eat something that's grown right there on the grounds that's very fresh. And it was...
Thank you so much for sharing. Lauren, maybe I'd like to leave you with some words and maybe just talk a little bit, if you want to respond to that, and then maybe go on just to mention a few things, what else your organization is doing right now.
Sure. Well, just in regards to the idea of self-reliance and self-determination, those are some concepts that we strongly value, and one of the things that we're trying to do with Milk Nut Jails is not just make it so that urban communities are self-reliant and rural communities are self-reliant, but that we're actually building regional systems where people can provide for the entire region each other.
Mm-hmm.
And right now we have the prison system really facilitating a lot of the relationships that people in upstate rural New York have with people from New York City or urban areas where they've never met someone from the city except someone that's been locked up in prison in their town, or the prison families that come on long bus rides to visit their loved ones. And so what we're trying to say is we see here that there's an economic relationship where that has a detrimental impact on how urban and rural people view each other.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we'd really like to see is farmers producing fresh, healthy food for communities that need it, that don't have as much space to grow it. And we think that'll be a much healthier relationship that urban and rural people can have. So it's not just about creating self-reliance and self-determination in your own community, but also facilitating healthy relationships between communities that might seem very different.
That is...
And so with that, the things that we're working on right now are, I know you all listed off the policies on our website, but we're actually trying to narrow that down to about 6 policy items that we're going to focus on for the next year or two. And so there's actually a poll on our website at milknotjails.org/policy where people can help us rank those issues.
Awesome. So
which farming and which prison issues they think are most important. And we'll be deciding on a policy agenda in the next week or two. So people should definitely
go online
and vote on
Lauren,
right now.
I am so sorry. Thank you so much. I just realized we are totally out of time. So you've got the Milk Not Jails. Go on to the website, check out the, you can fill out the form and survey, and we want to thank you again for joining us on Tell It Like It Is. Really appreciate it. And thank you again, Margot Pelletier, for joining us.
Thanks, Lauren.
Talk to you again soon,
I hope.
Thank you. Bye.